and Mrs. Edgerly saved twins and ensured their mother's safety. She was followed in this by Miss Miller, later Mrs. Sutherland, and by Mrs. Waddell, who by 1855 had a large number of twins in her house. As Mbua has also emphasised, African agency was essential to changes in the treatment of twins, whether kings or chiefs taking a public stand against the practice or the parents of twins seeking ways for their children to survive. this picture of Mrs. Sutherland, it's from her biography of her that was published in 1883, and again, this thing of women being depicted with children is a very typical image, as you will see with some of the other images later on. Reading through the missionary sources as I've been doing in preparation for this, it became very apparent that the practice of keeping African children in missionary households was widespread. And it was prevalent among single missionary women as well as married couples. Not all the children living in mission households were rescued twins. There were also babies who risked death following the death of their mother in or soon after childbirth. That is, if a mother died and the baby was very young, it was often either killed or exposed, in the sense that it wouldn't have anyone who would be able to bring it up. So babies orphaned in those circumstances were also taken in. There were also instances of chiefs requesting that daughters live in the mission house so they could be educated. And children were expected to contribute to the work of the household and were trained up in European modes of domestic labour. Indeed, the presence of African children seems to have been essential to the maintenance of the missionary lifestyle. And frugal though this may have been, it aimed to conform to certain European standards of household organisation, cuisine and so on. Children then might substitute for servants. Indeed, a letter from Slicer explicitly makes this point, and I quote, "You can have no hired servants trained like you get at home. You get children and teach them, and you're not to suppose heathen children superior to those of our civilised lands." End quote. So I think it does underline, it's a common practice. There was also that seemed for them to be training as Christian adults, it's partly that as well in a European mode, but I think they certainly seemed to be pretty much a central part of people's households. This image again is just to illustrate that trope, if you like, of women with infants, that Mary Slessor, of course, and this again from the Women's Mission magazine a bit earlier in 1904. A very typical image of women with children, as also with Mrs. Sutherland earlier. Another thing that happened with the children is that several missionaries took African children with them on furlough to Scotland, and Slessor wasn't the first to do so. They were typically objects of great interest. A photograph of a child accompanying Slessor in 1883 was advertised for sale in the Dundee Courier. And it's a bit ambiguous. It was a letter written in. It suggests that it was a commercial proposition that, you know, people should buy the photograph. Although I have to say, my own feeling would be it was probably being used for fundraising purposes, but I don't know specifically in that instance. But I think, generally speaking, the presence of African children would have been used to help fundraise and recruit. Arguably, the common emphasis in biographies of Slessor on saving twins and taking Christianity to recently contacted African communities has tended to obscure her day-to-day work. And much of this was typical of a woman missionary's remit. At the time of her arrival in Old Calabar, women were being recruited mainly to undertake educational work with girls and women. This involved setting up schools or more informal teaching of girls, visiting women in their compounds or villages with the aim of teaching basic literacy as well as evangelising. Many women missionaries also tended to medical needs of the local community, and this was occurring well before there were women doctors on the staff, although in due course the mission employed trained nurses and women doctors. So those sorts of activities typified the work of Slessor's predecessors and contemporaries. This is another image of women missionaries. This group of Yoruba women that they were working with in Duketown were in fact the wives of soldiers who had been recruited by the after the expansion of British power. So this was early 1904. So after the Aru expedition, and as a typical mode of divide and rule, I would say there was Hausa and Yoruba soldiers were recruited to come into the area where you had people of different tribal groups. Depictions of several of Slessor's predecessors also foreshadowed the tropes of courage and heroism that were later applied to her. Louise Anderson, under whose supervision Slessor was placed on her arrival, was described by one of the African leaders as best man for mission. While, although not masculine, as was said of Mrs. Sutherland, in courage, Mammy Sutherland was a man. And the courage that the women were depicted as displaying was in standing up to African men, in denouncing their customs and intervening to protect others. Mrs. Sutherland was also said to have gone where no white woman had gone before, as a trope that people were very fond of, being the first white person, and particularly the first white woman to encounter particular groups of Africans. This image is of Mary Slessor's house at Ekenge in Okoyong. I've no idea if I'm pronouncing things correctly, I have to say, in terms of the local, the epic language. But it shows a rather elaborate, you know, she's described having lived with Africans, and she did sometimes, I think, live in fairly basic conditions. But this is a fairly elaborate mission house, certainly capable of supporting missionary and a household of children. The evidence of mission records reported in other forms of publicity and commemoration of individual missionaries all suggests that Mary Slessor, for the first decades of her missionary career, was following paths that were already well-trodden, both literally and figuratively. And subsequently, there were two aspects of her work that were distinctive. The first was her initiation of new mission stations without being accompanied by a white male missionary. And I use that phrase advisedly because of how it's represented, or when how it's represented at the time, is that she did it alone. But she didn't do it alone. She did it with a household of children, with African assistants, where the catechist teaches men taking her goods in canoes and so on up the river. So, but she did it without a white male missionary being present. And then the other thing that was distinctive was, of course, her acceptance of an official position within the colonial administration. And this slide shows her actually presiding at the court. Both these aspects were to be seized on by later publicists, and both were made possible by expansion of British colonisation in the scramble for Africa. And this map, I think, this is from history of the United Presbyterian Church Mission, shows the location of their missions. You can see that southeastern Nigeria, contiguous to Cameroon, German territory, and further down here was French Congo, as you see, and that shows the scale. So although there's a lot of talk about moving into the interior and the sort of notion of going to the dark heart, we're actually talking about a relatively limited, difficult to communicate because it was a lot of mangrove swamps, tropical rainforests, but actually not huge distances. And of course, after particularly after 1902, when the British Empire extends further inland, the roads and railroads are built and communication and mobility changes. But that I think, gives you a sense of the place in the empire as well as the range of the mission stations related to Old Calabar. As I said, the aspects of Slessor's career were, I think, made possible by British colonisation and the scramble for Africa. And indeed, the context in which the Old Calabar mission was operating was changing rapidly by the turn of the century. In southeastern Nigeria, a British protectorate was established in 1891. for the Consul General at Calabar, together with other colonial officials, a military presence and armed police force. British power was progressively extended in West Africa with occasional punitive military expeditions, such as that against the Arab people in 1902. Endorsed by the mission and lent support in the form of medical help, this expedition made possible Slessor's entry into the region. British colonial administration was relatively minimal. As Adrian Hastings has described it, it was a cheap and feeble colonialism which used subcontractors to extend the scope of British rule. And both chiefs and missionaries came into the category of subcontractors. And Slessor's appointment to court duties, I think, should be understood in this light. It's interesting to note that her mission colleagues did not approve of her taking on this role, as they thought that working hand in hand with the government would compromise her position as a missionary to Africans. And it's a moot point how her role might have been perceived from an African perspective. All the evidence we have tends to come from white people, whether it's missions or colonial records. But Africans too had their political motives in inviting missionaries into their communities. As Hastings puts it, African rulers' approaches to missionaries were matters of political stratagem. The social disruption and dislocation caused by colonial power, by the advance of colonial power, produced different responses to Christianity among African communities. Adrian Hastings, classically, is the person who has probably written most about this. But there were several examples of rapid adoption of Christianity. In some cases, Hastings has argued, Africans effectively Christianised themselves. And the missionary communications from the old Calabar stations at the time, particularly after the Arrow expedition, including those of Slessor, convey the sense of change and of opportunity for proselytisation. And very much a situation where it was the Bible following the flag, whereas previously it had been the other way round. I'd like now to sort of discuss the process of iconisation and say who were the key players in that. Just to summarise also, I've indicated there was a well-developed foreign mission movement in Scotland by the late 19th century. Women were an integral part of this. The old Calabar was well-established missionary practice among women missionaries that Mary Slessor adopted and applied in new missions. The changes wrought by colonialism in West Africa facilitated the rise of Christianity and increased demand for missionaries. So there was much about Slessor's missionary career that was not unique to her. And why was she then selected as the subject of popular biography and of sanctification? The iconisation of Slessor followed speedily after her death. Prior publicity given to her, however, sowed the seeds from which the legend grew. In the missionary press, her work was reported alongside that of many other women, although she had begun to be promoted as a pioneer in the early 1900s. Reports in the secular press helped promote the pioneer image too, although such coverage was limited to a few occasions. Mary Kingsley has been credited with bringing Slessor to the attention of a wider public in 1897 on the publication of her travels in West Africa. And the following year, an interview by a Reuters correspondent in Liverpool was reported in several newspapers, an interview with Slessor, that is, on which she was about to return to Old Calabar, having been on a furlough, including the Dundee Courier and the Scotsman. I've looked at those two papers as most likely to have coverage and haven't extended more widely, although I think what I found there may be replicated in some other Scottish newspapers, and the Reuters material I think has been reported in the Times and perhaps other English or UK papers. The Courier printed the interview at length under sensationalist headlines, Child Sacrifice, Horrible Story from Old Calabar, and Wholesale Murder of Twin Babies, while the Scotsman carried a shorter, more restrained version, headlined The Murder of Twin Children in West Africa. Otherwise, mentions of Slessor were confined to reports of missionary meetings, although her honour in 1913 was duly noted, both in the Courier and Scotland. And I don't know if you can read that very well, but it just illustrates the slightly different tone in the newspapers. Slessor, of course, is a local heroine, so she gets more coverage in the Dundee Courier. But it was only on her death that her missionary history was given more extensive coverage. And this described her as having had a romantic career and labelled her the White Queen of Calabar. Later references in the secular press were relatively rare. For example, the opening of the 1923 memorial at Dundee's Albert Institute, a radio broadcast about her life in 1936, and church services and exhibitions on the centenary of her birth in 1948. It was above all W.P. Livingstone's biography which created the legend. And prior to its publication, I think it's worth noting that several women had been among Slessor's publicists. Mary Kingsley, and the interesting thing about Kingsley was she talked favourably about Slessor, but was otherwise critical of missionaries. Elizabeth Watson, the wife of a Dundee minister, wrote under the pen name of D.S. Cromarty. She was a journalist and novelist, and she wrote about Slessor. And the editors of the Women's Missionary Magazine were also women of the Foreign Mission Committee in Edinburgh, were active in editing and presenting under headlines, I think, a particular slant on her work. And indeed, it was the Foreign Mission Women's Committee that played the crucial role in commissioning two biographies, the first for an adult audience and a second for girls and boys. And this is a cover of the one for children. This is one I've picked up in a second-hand bookshop. And this was being published, it was published in 1956, and there's apparently Edinburgh University Library has one from 1967. So you can see the sort of imagery that's still being reproduced a number of decades after her death. W.P. Livingstone was the editor of the United Free Church Missionary Record, and he brought to his task a theory of racial hierarchy and devolution that he had formulated in the course of a journalistic career in Jamaica. In his view, it was in Africa that Africans were the most barbarous, and only through contact with the civilizing influence of Europeans could they develop their human potential. In his book, Black Jamaica, he argued that Jamaica provided evidence of such evolution. In particular, the efforts of missionaries and the moral discipline of the churches had led to the most rapid progress for the Negro in throwing off his aboriginal traits. And these are, of course, quotes from Livingstone. Livingstone strongly held views about racial hierarchy framed his missionary biographies, of which his 1916 publication on Slessor was the first. And he went on to write, well, at least half a dozen others, possibly more, of Scottish missionaries. This was infused with a mix of racial stereotyping, vilification of African peoples, romanticising of missionary life, and glorification of the empire. And it's not possible to say how widely his views might have been endorsed at the time, or if another contemporary biographer might have written a more measured and less racist text. There's no sense, however, that the Women's Foreign Mission Committee were displeased with the result, and it's striking that Livingstone's works were still cited as classics on his death in 1950, and that included particularly the Mary Slessor biography, but also the Black Jamaica volume. There was a conscious attempt, both by W.P. Livingstone and others, to model Slessor's image as a female counterpart to David Livingstone, someone who, through education and self-help, rose from humble origins to dedicate herself to the service of others. It's worth noting, however, that the environment of mid-19th century Dundee, from which she emerged, was one which bred strong women and fostered aspirations for education and respectability. And this is the school that she, the half-time school she went to when she started to work in the mill and herself as a girl. She was schooled as a half-timer, which was something that happened successfully in Dundee, but also in other industrial areas. That is, went half-time to school and worked half-time from the ages of 11 to 14. And then she worked full-time in the mill. She attended evening classes and also, as a member of the United Presbyterian Church, was active in philanthropic circles, which encouraged working class education and cultural pursuits. So a sort of lively culture in Dundee at that, particularly in mid-century period, before a kind of real organisation of trade unions, where you really have a lot of effort being put by churches and middle classes into providing cultural and leisure pursuits and encouraging education for members of the working classes. Slessor was a beneficiary of this, and she received the support both of ministers and of lay church leaders. Also, as a weaver in an industry dominated by women, and as a skilled worker, she would have become habituated to earning a living and supporting her family, as well as, I think, acquiring habits of independence. It was a female-dominated labour force, many of whom were the breadwinners in their families. Some representations of mill work is obviously the photographs a bit beyond her time, but it is interesting how the earlier image, and it's a drawing based on earlier materials, but they're very similar in their take, and as we will see also in the memorial windows, as we saw was seen earlier in the memorial window at her mill, at the mill. Her choice of a missionary career was unusual for a working class woman, although I think what I'm trying to emphasise here is she wouldn't have been unique in having those kind of opportunities. And one of the routes that working class women did have was to become teachers by the 1870s, but they'd already had the opportunity to train as pupil teachers, and there was a great expansion after the 1872 Act. But it's a paradox that Slessor is held up as an iconic figure of a movement which was already overwhelmingly professionalised and middle class. So there were a number of factors which contributed to the choice of Slessor as an emblematic female missionary, and among them the following seem prominent. It's apparent that the Women's Foreign Mission Committee were keen to have a narrative that would fit the then popular genre of missionary biographies, which were capable of reaching a wide readership beyond the circle of mission supporters who were the consumers of early missionary literature. Missionary exploits in Africa provided particularly fertile ground for this, as they offered elements of adventure and exoticism that could titillate and thrill, as well as purvey a message of the role of Christianity in the civilising mission. It is not hard to see how the missionary experience in Old Calabar could be shaped to fit this mould. And it's also clear that leading women mission supporters desired to promote the idea of the women pioneer missionary who could work autonomously and be rewarded with success. So there's some gender politics going on there. Moreover, the combination of religious and secular achievement was a winning one. Slessor's imperial connection was paraded as much as a Christian charity. Given the context also of the First World War, and where German Cameroon was contiguous to British southeastern Nigeria, imperial patriotism was being encouraged at home. Thus, both the pre-war and wartime context conditioned her presentation as fitting the self-help model so cherished by the church-going middle classes. And this image was promulgated at a time when working-class women were asserting themselves at work, in trade unions and politically, a probable cause of alarm, or concern perhaps rather than alarm, for middle-class Scots. So whether striking duke workers, suffrage supporters or rent strike activists, working women were taking collective action to improve their conditions and gain political rights. The image of heroic Christian self-sacrifice acted as a reproof to such ambitions. Furthermore, the sanctification of Slessor was premised on her role as the saviour of children, and thus she could be recuperated to represent dedicated motherhood, or to some extent this is in tension with the image of her as intrepid pioneer. But arguably, the politics of empire, class and gender came together in shaping the image of Mary Slessor. Some remarks in conclusion.